From the tragic case of the Sullivan brothers in World War II to the lesser-known but significant involvement in the Civil War, Iowans have a long history of fighting for their country. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We conclude Iowa Week on River to River with stories from Iowa's military history. We'll hear from Jim Sullivan, son of Albert Sullivan, the youngest of Iowa's Sullivan brothers, Bob Niemeyer of the Grout Museum District in Waterloo, Marcus Eckert of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, also the remarkable life of Air Force Colonel, former POW and Medal of Honor recipient, George Bud Day, who died earlier this year, and my 2010 conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta of Hiawatha, the first living person since the Vietnam War to receive the Medal of Honor. It's all coming up. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. From the tragic case of the Sullivan brothers in World War II to the lesser-known but significant involvement in the Civil War, Iowans have a long history of fighting for our country. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we conclude Iowa Week on our talk shows with stories from Iowa's military history. It's really this hour just a few individual snapshots from wars that Iowans were involved in. Don't think of this as a comprehensive summary. Of course, we couldn't do that in 1 hour. And I want to say that in case you were a loved one who served in a war that is given scant attention in the next hour, excuse us, but we are indebted, of course, to all veterans in combat and otherwise who have served their country. Later in the hour, the remarkable life of Air Force Colonel, former Vietnam POW and Medal of Honor recipient George Bud Day, who died earlier this year. Also later in the hour, my 2010 conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta of Hiawatha, the first living person since the Vietnam War to receive the Medal of Honor. Joining me for this first half hour, Bob Niemeyer is with us, historian at the Grout Museum District in Waterloo in our Cedar Falls studio. Hi, Bob.
Good morning.
Good afternoon. We're just into the afternoon hours. Good afternoon to you, Bob. And Marcus Eckert is with us, the museum curator at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library in West Branch. Marcus Eckert in our Iowa City studio. Hi to you, Marcus.
Good morning, or good afternoon.
There we go, all on the same time zone. Let me start with you, Bob Niemeyer, because we're going to, in the next few minutes, have a very fleeting, quick look at several wars and Iowa connections to them. Let's start with the Civil War. Tell us the extent of Iowa's involvement in the Civil War. Some basic facts, if you could start out with that, Bob.
Certainly. The numbers generally are about 76,000 Iowans volunteered to serve in the Civil War, approximately half of the adult population of the time, which is quite remarkable given the fact that Iowa was sort of on the periphery of some of the debate that led to the Civil War. Of that 76,000, 13,000 plus did not return home. The casualty rate was high. And, you know, a lot of that was wounds, combat situations. Other was disease. And those numbers made Iowa one of the largest contributors per capita in the Union Army.
Mm-hmm. And in the middle of the 19th century, so this really meant something to go off to war. You're leaving, in Iowa's case, often a farm, aren't you? A lot of chores that don't get done by that person.
Sure. I mean, after the first regiment went off, everybody signed up for 3 years, and most extended into that fourth year, which left behind on the home front, left behind stores to run, farms to keep up, families to take care of. And so the story of both the soldiers and the home front are things that we talk about in our museum, using letters, diaries, autobiographies, things like that.
Marcus Eckert, you are at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library in West Branch, and you have been researching letters sent by soldiers during the Civil War for the Iowans in the Civil War exhibit that's still ongoing, a remarkable exhibit that I've seen and will be up until the end of October, I think.
Yes, October 27th.
Tell us what the sense you got from your research in these letters sent by Civil War soldiers, and perhaps share an excerpt.
I found it really interesting to deal with the letters as opposed to the diaries. The letters tend to be written for an audience, family members or friends who they're writing to, and it's a different audience. They write differently depending on if they're writing to families or friends. a letter I have here from an 18-year-old young man who was from Mechanicsville, Iowa, who joined late when he was 18 in 1864. I am well and growing fat every day. I gained 5 pounds heavier than I did when I came here. And then he talks about how he sent stuff off. And then I got vaccinated day before yesterday. I could not get it done before as there is no smallpox here. So he's talking about some of the early medicine. Now, his name is Melvin Briggs, and he actually spent a fair amount of his time in military hospitals. And that's interesting how he writes about that, too. Mm-hmm.
Is this the case where he was there's an interesting way that they could vaccinate themselves against smallpox in this case? I think that was in the Briggs letter, right? Tell us about that.
If they would find somebody who had smallpox, then they would take the scabs off of the pox, and they would, in some cases, they would like make an open wound or a little cut or a prick and touch it to that spot, and then that would vaccinate them by giving them the virus or whatever it is. And then also in one of his other letters, he talks about taking scabs off of his own arms and sending those in letters and mailing those back home to vaccinate his family.
That is amazing. Bob Niemeyer, tell us about one person that I know you've got a lot of individuals you could talk about. Tell us about one person from the Civil War.
One of the people that we feature is Grenville Dodge. And again, all of our stories about Iowans. Dodge was a surveyor living in Council Bluffs. The war broke out. He organized a militia, actually helped get both a militia unit, regiment off, and a artillery unit. And then he joined the military himself, was commissioned officer, went heroics at Pea Ridge, the battle in 1862, wounded several other times during the war, and ended up in Atlanta, the Battle of Atlanta. But one of the things about Grenville Dodge that most people don't know is that he established an intelligence unit or a spy network. Hmm. And so he operated, I think, about 100 to 120 people, many of them women, many of them people who had formerly been slaves, and helped the Union collect intelligence of what was happening on the Confederate side of the line. So other people know him as the man who helped to get the Transcontinental Railroad done. But his Civil War story is a very unique one.
And Bob, I think you can point out that two unique military units came from Iowa, a regiment of African-Americans and also a regiment called the Graybeards.
Great. The 60th, the regiment that was sometimes called the Regiment of African Descent, was put together in 63, 64. And it was made up of young men from Iowa and from Missouri, who either were free men themselves, as Archie Clark, who sort of helped to organize it, or people who had been slaves at one point in time. And this unit was dispatched and eventually became part of the federal or the Union government, but was sent to Louisiana and to Arkansas, saw combat, not a lot, but a very unique one that sort of paralleled the story with some of the Massachusetts units. The Graybeards, my favorite, given the age. The 37th Iowa was a regiment put together by men whose sons or grandsons were fighting. These were men who were sort of over the age, averaging someplace between 57 and 60. And they ran around and did guard duty on trains at prison camps to free up younger men who then could be funneled back into the infantry units and particularly in the push from Atlanta to the sea.
Mm-hmm. If we can move from the Civil War on to World War I, we're running short of time. I wish we could spend an hour on each of these. So many fascinating stories. But after the United States declared war on Germany in April of 1917, more than 500,000 Iowans, again, the numbers are staggering when you think about the population at that time, between the ages of 18 and 45, registered for the draft. Iowa, according to my numbers, Bob, sent 114,000, over 114,000 men and women to serve in the armed forces.
That's correct. And again, in Iowa was interesting because the enemy was Germany. And there were a lot of these young men and women who went off who were German to the core. And so the questions of, who are we fighting? Are we fighting our cousins, our nephews, our nieces, was one that a lot of Iowans raised. But the British and then later on the United States did a very effective propaganda effort to portray the Germans as, you know, baby killers and mm-hmm. make sure that they – that everybody knew they were the enemy. And Iowa troops very much fell in line. Casualty rates were high in part because of combat, in part because they got caught up in the Spanish influenza at the end of the war.
Marion Crandall, I have as the first woman to die of injuries in combat in World War I. Merle Hay, one of the first combat casualties in World War I from Iowa. Tell us briefly about those two.
Merle Hay from Glidden, part of the 1st Division, the Red Bull Division. He was in France in November of 1917, one of the earliest troops to be deployed in that area. Caught in trench warfare, there was an attack over the top by the Germans. He and one or two other young men were the first to be killed, and that honor was sort of divided between him and Merle Hay and a couple of other people. Marion Campbell Crandall was a French teacher, born in Cedar Rapids, teaching in Davenport, who went, like a lot of other young Americans, a lot of young Iowans, went to Europe to do good, okay? She worked for the YMCA canteens. This was sort of, you know, providing food and services to American and Allied troops in Europe. She was doing her job, and a bomb came in and destroyed the building she was in, and she was killed.
Okay. Bob Niemeyer with us, along with Marcus Eckhart, as we're recalling Iowans' involvement in various wars. Let's move now to World War II, the U.S. entering World War II, December 8, 1941, the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor, registering 882,000, over 882,000 young men. And from Iowa, 262,000 men and women serving in some branch of the armed forces. Also joining us for this part of the conversation in Cedar Falls in our studio, Jim Sullivan is with us, the son of Albert Sullivan, the youngest of the Iowans, the Sullivan brothers. Jim Sullivan, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bob, before I ask Jim about how his family remembers this, tell us briefly the story of the Sullivan brothers.
Well, the five brothers, George, Francis, Joseph, Madison, and Albert decided to enlist after learning about Pearl Harbor, loss of a good friend, Bill Ball. They went to the Navy. They wanted to sign up together, serve together. The Navy said no. The Navy changed its mind and said yes. They were assigned to a ship called the USS Juno. And during the Battle of Guadalcanal in November of 1942, the ship was damaged. As it was going back for repairs, it was hit by a Japanese submarine. Of the 700 people on the ship, perhaps 100 survived. Records show that George, the oldest, was one of those. Everybody else perished because of miscommunication and everything. Of those 700, only 10 people survived or were rescued, and none of the five brothers were part of that rescue team.
Jim Sullivan, tell us, why did they all want to, why were they all so fervent about serving together?
Well, it's my understanding that they had a real good friend, Bill Ball, that was killed in the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Mm, that was it. What part, how is this story remembered in your family? There's so much national attention given to your father and your uncles. How is this mostly remembered in your family?
Well, of course, there's the first destroyer named after my dad and my uncles, 537 Sullivans, and in 97, I believe it was, there was a second destroyer that was christened and commissioned, USS the Sullivans, which is on duty right now. And so that's a big part of in our family, especially my daughter Kelly, mm-hmm. because she sponsored the newer Sullivan ship, so she's in contact with them quite a bit.
The nation celebrates your father and your uncles all together. I wonder how you as a family mark that date and remember them.
Well, I mean, we're reminded of it quite often and think about it quite often. Really, all I knew about my dad, my uncles, because I was less than 2 years old when they were killed, is what, you know, has been told to me. And a lot of times when I'm introduced to people even nowadays and say my name is Sullivan, they ask me about that. So, mm-hmm. you know, it happens all the time, and I think about it quite a bit myself.
Bob Niemeyer, there's the Sullivan Brothers Iowa Veterans Museum in Waterloo. What can people see there?
Well, first of all, it is dedicated to the service and sacrifice of the five Sullivan brothers, and Jim and Kelly and John of the family have been very helpful in getting it going and to support it. It represents, the brothers represent the service and sacrifice of all Iowa veterans. And what we do is we talk about veterans. We don't talk so much about the equipment side. We don't have tanks, a lot of things that are real material. But we talk about the service of people who serve. What are those stories? We have an oral history program that has over 1,500 videotaped oral histories, at least an hour in length. And so by capturing these stories and then working them into the exhibits, into educational programming, into productions, we reflect the story that people tell us. The people's stories are the best stories. The historians can write about things, but having people, whether it's Jim or it's other members of the World War II generation or even the current conflicts, OEF, OAF, having them tell what they experienced, that's the best part, and that's what people really enjoy seeing when they come to visit us.
In learning about this, I understand there is a misconception about the aftermath of the Sullivan brothers, that they're a lot of people, I think there was an act by Congress that would prevent a similar thing happen, having so many family members go down at once on a same ship. And then that's not correct?
That is not correct. Mm. I mean, there is no law stating that. The military tries to, you know, discourage that, but there is no law for that, no. Mm-hmm.
Bob, but is there any sort of policy?
The policy seems to vary by service. I think the Army and the Navy are most keenly attuned to not putting, you know, brothers and sisters, a family together, you know, and Saving Private Ryan sort of brings that or reminds us of that story. But the Air Force is a little bit less adamant, I think, in that. And the guard units, because they come from, you know, communities, oftentimes there are three people all related, brothers and sisters, who are in those guard units. So when they deploy to Iraq and Afghanistan, they are in close quarters with family members.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to jump in here, Marcus?
Going back to the Civil War, I think maybe not family, but whole communities would enlist together. So you would have a whole town could be lost. The whole next generation of men from that family could be lost in one battle. And I think that was not an uncommon thing, but I think you would lose whole areas. So you're talking about they're taking care of their friends. You're talking about their families. Oh, you know so-and-so, he got shot. He got killed. So when you're reading the letters from the people, I think that's different than the oral histories, as the letters are there in the moment. And the oral histories are recollections of years later.
Mm, that's a good point, Marcus. Let's, before we have to say goodbye and touch, let's touch upon the Vietnam War, as we'll be having, we'll learn about a Vietnam POW in our second half hour. Bob, during the Vietnam War years, 1964 to 73, I have 115,000 Iowans serving in all branches of the military. What else can you tell us?
Well, I mean, the death toll compared to the percentages of World War I are perhaps lower, but the numbers show from the Iowa Veterans Affairs website is 869. And what is interesting, there are still 25 people who are listed as MIA, that is no body, no nothing has been recovered to identify that person. And we just recognized somebody, Robert Rex, last Friday because it was MIA, POW MIA Recognition Day. These people, the families, assume they are dead. It's been, the evidence is there. But We still have people who have families who have no tangible record or indication of their loss of their loved ones.
Mm-hmm. We want to play some music here as we go into this break, but I wonder if I can ask you, Marcus, to get out another a letter to read it, and perhaps we can set this up to have a little bit of music behind you as you read a letter in just a moment. Give you time to find that in the few seconds that we have left. Before that, Bob Niemeyer, tell us about one of the last two casualties of the Vietnam War. Was an Iowan, a 19-year-old Darwin Judge of Marshalltown, wasn't it?
Most, in fact, virtually all American troops left by 1973, but the Marine Corps had their embassy delegation that did protection. And as the American troops were leaving in April of 1975, and he was helping to protect and supervise the departure of the embassy, there was a round that came in from the Viet Cong and killed himself and another young man, designated as the last two Americans to die in the Vietnam conflict.
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't touched on the Korean conflict. What can you tell us about that, Bob, very briefly?
I think the numbers are very similar, 507 lost, MIA is 79. I think we're talking with a lot of Korean War veterans now, and I think they are finally coming. They're enjoying being recognized for their service. The America's Forgotten War, Korea, is no longer forgotten, and indeed many people want to say it is America's forgotten victory. So talking with them and finding out what it was like at the Joseon Reservoir or what it was like in some of the other places of horrendous fighting in Korea, mm-hmm. in the POW situations, has been really helpful. And it's a step away from the World War II generation and a step different from Vietnam.
Jim Sullivan, it's been nice having you with us on the program. I wonder, very briefly, we don't have much time, but is there a connection between the story, the real-life story of the Sullivan brothers and the Steven Spielberg film Saving Private Ryan? Of course, that's purely fictional, but a similar theme.
I guess so.
Was Steven Spielberg perhaps inspired by the Sullivan brothers' story?
I think maybe he was, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us, Jim Sullivan, the son of Albert Sullivan, youngest of the Iowa Sullivan brothers, who all perished on one ship in the Second World War. And also Bob Niemeyer, thank you very much for joining us. And how can people find out more about the history that you have going on there at the Grout Museum District?
We have a Facebook page, Grout Museum. Tells what's going on a regular basis. We're open Tuesday through Saturday, 9 to 5. Come in and see the exhibits. Come in and get a membership and bring your home family for not only one day that you're there, but another visit. It takes time to get through.
Okay, Marcus Eckhart, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. The Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library, that exhibit on Iowans in the Civil War through the end of October. We're going to have a little music for you to read a little bit of a letter for. You've got about 30 or 40 seconds. Go ahead, Marcus, and thank you for joining us.
All right. This is parts of a letter from John Walter Lee of the Iowa 22nd, which mustered out of Iowa City. And he's talking about the news of Lincoln's death. We are enjoying ourselves finally nowadays over the good news, but on Monday we receive very bad news, which has put a stop to our joyfulness. The assassination of President Lincoln has cast a gloom of sorrow over all. We can hardly believe it, for we have seen no official news from Washington, but we are fearful. The flags have all been at half-mast since we got the first reports. I cannot tell you or express the feelings of the men, and we are waiting very patiently indeed.
Okay, thank you, Marcus Eckhart. Coming up, the remarkable story of George Budd Day. Also, my conversation with Sal Junta of Hiawatha. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we're concluding Iowa Week with stories from Iowa's military history. In the first half hour, we observed Iowa's military history from the Civil War up to World War II and then also touched on Vietnam. And now we remember two other Iowans who served. In just a moment, we'll listen back to my 2010 conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta of Hiawatha, who served in Afghanistan. He's the first living person since the Vietnam War to receive the Medal of Honor. But first, the remarkable life of Air Force Colonel, former Vietnam POW, and Medal of Honor recipient George Budd Day. He died earlier this year at the age of 88. Day was born February 24, 1925, in Sioux City, and that's where the airport is now named for him. Earlier this year, I spoke with Master Sergeant John Sandman of the 185th Air Refueling Wing, who is a friend of Day. And I began by asking him about Bud Day's early life and the fact that he joined the Marines in high school.
He actually quit high school to join up, and he was so small and light, the recruiter said, go eat a bunch of bananas and come back and weigh in tomorrow, and we'll see if we can get you up to the proper weight to join.
Did that work?
Yes, apparently they said, go ahead, kid, if you're that concerned about joining, we'll let you go.
Sergeant Sandman, tell us a little bit more, if you could, about his service during World War II.
Yeah, he actually joined the Marines, and he was in the Pacific Theater. As I understood from his history, he was in a lot of the places where there was action.
Mm-hmm. What are any details about his work in Korea, the Korean War?
Just that he flew some missions there, and that's where he really perfected his pilot skills, and he started moving up in rank. And this led to him being asked to be put in charge of the forward air control squadron in Vietnam, the famous Misties, as they were called, and some phenomenal pilots and individuals came out of that squadron, and it all was started under Colonel Day's leadership.
Mm-hmm. Then came the Vietnam War, shot down over North Vietnam in 1967, spending over 5 years as a POW, a prisoner of war, in, among other places, the infamous Hanoi Hilton. He bailed out, but on the landing, I understand, broke his knee, his right arm. That injury left him also temporarily blind in one eye. What did he tell you about those 5 years?
Well, it's interesting. Our air crew and my job, we go through the combat survival school that the Air Force provides for that reason. So if you are captured by the enemy or you have to survive off the land before rescue, that's just a 2.5-week school. And we're thinking, okay, this was not fun for 2.5 weeks. Imagine doing it for 5.5 years. So the most impressive thing is that they never gave up hope. And if they did give up hope, they got right back the next day. And they're just able to maintain this sense of honor and duty for that long of a period of time when, again, they had no contact with the outside world. They had no idea if anyone knew they were even a prisoner.
Now, when he did get out, was released in the early 1970s, he had lost the use of his arms. They had hung him by his arms until they came out of their sockets, right?
Right. Imagine having your arms tied behind your back and then hung from an apparatus from a ceiling or a beam and hung there until you basically dislocate both shoulders. Just beyond belief. And unimaginable torture and pain, and to maintain dignity in that situation is just, like I said, it's just beyond belief almost.
Mm-hmm. He was Senator John McCain's cellmate at the infamous Hanoi Hilton. In a statement this past weekend, Senator McCain called Colonel Day a great patriot and said he, John McCain, owed his life to this man. Here's a quote from John McCain. "He was the bravest man I ever knew, and his fierce resistance and resolute leadership set the example for us in prison of how to return home with honor." That's quite a tribute. At the time that they were POWs, Day would have outranked John McCain.
Yes, yes. And they did follow very closely the chain of command. The highest-ranking person in the environment is supposed to make the decisions. And luckily for those prisoners, it was Colonel Day in a lot of situations. Others did, come in and out of the scene. But his leadership is what was so extraordinary. Not only did he lead by example, but they said when they could communicate such great advice on what to do, how to handle each day, just how to maintain some kind of dignity and represent the United States in the best way they could.
George Bud Day received the Medal of Honor among many other awards. He received that Medal of Honor for escaping his captors for 10 days after the aircraft he was piloting was shot down over North Vietnam in 1967. In all, 70 medals during his service during World War II, Korea, Vietnam. I'm wondering, are there servicemen? That's a rare thing, isn't it, to have served in all three of those wars, isn't it?
Exactly. That's so rare. And to keep moving up in leadership positions and earn the respect that he has is equally rare. But the great sense of humor that Colonel Day had. He said someone asked him about all his medals and awards, and he said if you look real close though, you'll see that I did not have the good conduct ribbon here. Joking that in his younger days he was out there and a typical young Iowa boy and living on the edge a little bit maybe.
Okay. Later, veterans will be thankful that he became a crusader for veterans' health care benefits. What can you tell us about that?
The most amazing thing, and some of us have talked to him, and he kind of jokes about that maybe God kept him alive for that reason. He literally, World War II and Korean veterans were promised health care if they served. But unfortunately, a lot of those promises were verbal promises. There was a few instances where they were written down, but it wasn't a nationwide thing. But they were being denied health care, so Colonel Day literally sued the United States government. Here, so you have a Medal of Honor winner suing the government, the most patriotic human being you can find, suing his government to provide health care for the veterans. And it went through a couple higher courts and eventually was turned down by the Supreme Court. But because of his lawsuit against the government to provide health care for veterans, TRICARE for Life was passed by Congress. And I can't tell you how many veterans I saw come up and hug Colonel Day, shake his hand, tears in their eyes, and so grateful that they said, Colonel, you know, because of this, my stomach ailment got cured. Because of this, my leg was fixed. Because of this. And he was so humble. He'd say, no, it wasn't me. I'm glad it happened. And, you know, he would never take credit for it. But the fact of the matter is, American military members today have TRICARE for Life almost 100% entirely because of Colonel Day's actions.
Mm. What should we as a nation and as the state of Iowa, proud native state of Colonel Day, what should we remember most about him?
He was the ultimate role model. He led life. I mean, I'm a military member, and he definitely gave a great example of how to be a military member, how to do everything right. But expanded from that is he was a great family man. He couldn't have been happier. He couldn't have been more positive through his whole life. And he was just one of those people that was if you met him, you're going to smile and you're going to be happy that you're with him. And he made your day better. And he was just an incredible positive force.
Mm-hmm. Master Sergeant John Sandman of the 185th Air Refueling Wing, we want to thank you for helping us remember this great Iowan. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, sir.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finally today, as a part of Iowa Week, as we look at Iowa military history, we listen back to my 2010 conversation with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta of Hiawatha. Junta graduated from Kennedy High School in Cedar Rapids in 2003. He is the first living recipient of the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War. And he received his honor for actions in a remote area of eastern Afghanistan back in October of 2007. According to Army reports, when an insurgent force ambush split Junta's squad into two groups, he exposed himself to enemy fire to pull a comrade back to cover. And later, while engaging the enemy and attempting to link up with the rest of his squad, Junta noticed two insurgents carrying away a fellow soldier. He immediately engaged the enemy, killing one and wounding the other, and provided medical aid to his wounded comrade, while the rest of his squad caught up and provided security. I spoke with Sal Junta back in 2010 and began by asking him how that day started and what his mission was.
That day in Afghanistan started the same way pretty much any day starts. We were on a patrol, and it was part of a bigger mission. It was the fifth day of a mission called Rock Avalanche, and we set off before daybreak so we could walk under the cover of night to set up in our position overwatching a village there in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. So this is a regular day. This is you're on patrol setting it to set up a position. This is nothing out of the ordinary.
No. I serve with the 173rd Airborne Infantry, and that is what our job is. Usually whatever they ask of us, we'll do, but a patrol is usually what they ask of us. So. Mm-hmm.
And how does that patrol and setting up that position fit into the overall strategy of what's happening in that part of Afghanistan?
That day, our mission, because it was part of a bigger mission called Rock Avalanche, our piece of the mission was, as 1st Platoon, and there was about 18 of us that day, was going to be, it was about a two-hour walk up to set up an overwatch over a village where another platoon is going to go into the village and engage the people of the village and let them know, hey, you know, we're here for you. We're not bad guys. We'll help you if you need help. We're trying to make your lives better. And our job was to basically pull a 360-degree circle on top of our ridge so we can protect ourselves and also watch the high ground so no one's set up on the people in the village and kind of take them by surprise. So we're just, you know, trying to keep everyone safe.
Mm-hmm. Had you any indications early on that there were unfriendly forces around?
There's always unfriendly forces around.
Yeah. Do you encounter these forces every week, every month, every day?
During that last, during the deployment that we're talking about was OEF-8, and we were in the Korngal Valley, so we were, you know, encountering forces, or I guess not necessarily encountering the forces, but at least getting shot at maybe one time a day, maybe three times a day, and then towards the winter, you know, it turns into more survival, so there's not a whole lot of kinetic activity going on, and we wouldn't get shot at for 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. I understand at one point there was an ambush that split your squad into two groups. This is the squad of 18, if I'm understanding this correctly. How did that happen?
You know, they got lucky. The way the terrain dictates how we move, the mountains in the Korngal Valley are so steep and so difficult to navigate that you have to walk kind of certain trails, you know, otherwise you're just going to fall down the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we needed to walk back to go back to the Korngal outpost, which is where we were going that night, was we had to walk on this trail because the decline, or the almost like a cliff face we were taking, it was only, I don't know, walkable by this trail at that point. And we walked, and they had set up on us during the day. I mean, the way the train was and the way the mountain fell off, that they could be close to us, maybe 200 meters where we sat all day, and we'd never see them just because the way your vision works.
And they knew, or they had a good guess, that you would be coming that way.
I guess they had a pretty good guess, yeah, that day.
The ambush begins. How many of them were there?
There's all sorts of different reports and stuff about that. I mean, for me, looking back on and thinking about it, maybe 10, maybe 15, maybe 20. I don't really know. You know, I think if I really gave a number, I'd be too, you know, I'd probably exaggerate just because that day it seemed like a million, you know.
Mm-hmm. I understand that it's difficult for you to talk about that. You lost two men in your unit, one of them a good friend of yours, so I understand that it's hard to talk about this, but what can you tell us about the moment that earned you this Medal of Honor?
The moment, or the reason, or I mean, why I'm talking to you today, I guess, is I did what I did because that's what we as infantry, that's what we as United States service members serving in faraway lands are asked to do, and we're asked to look out for each other and also serve the people, or serve the people's wishes back here. And that day, I didn't do anything in my eyes spectacular or amazing, because there was a lot of things that were going on and there was a lot of danger, and no one person was in more danger or less danger than the other ones. And I was able to do what I did because all the guys that I was with were doing everything they could, and that was just the next step. And the next step for me was to run forward. And when I ran forward, I kind of came into some stuff I didn't really expect. But
according to the military's reports, when this insurgent force ambush split your squad into two groups, you exposed yourself to enemy fire to pull a comrade back to cover. And that's what you're referring to. And when you rushed forward to rescue the member of your unit, you killed at least one of the insurgents, injured another one. I'm wondering, when you do that, what are the chief questions or decisions running through your mind? Or is that really the wrong question. Do you have time to make a conscious decision?
That day, we encountered an L-shaped ambush, and that is, if you're in the ambush, you're the one doing the ambush, it's a good thing. If you're caught in the ambush, it's a bad thing, but it's definitely something that we in the military train. This, I mean, we're carrying weapons, we're carrying guns, not just because they look cool in pictures, but because we're asked to use them. And so this is a very real scenario that anyone could find themselves in. And it was, we were able to act as a unit, as a team, as a squad, as a platoon, and everyone knew what they had to do, and everyone was doing what they had to do. So as far as a thought process, there really wasn't one. It was, we were just going through the motions that were already ingrained in us from probably basic training in the Army.
So it was a reflex, intuitive.
Absolutely.
And everyone in your unit acted as one.
We did. No one's concerned about themselves in that situation. Everyone's concerned about the person to their left and the person to their right. The same I am for them, they are for me, and that's what makes it all work out, because the individual isn't the one that matters, it's the group.
Many soldiers, I think, before they see combat, must wonder what they would do in such a situation as you found yourself in. Will I do what I was trained to do? Will I act effectively, honorably, quickly, make good decisions? Did you wonder about those sort of questions beforehand?
In that situation, no one likes to think about an ambush, especially such a close ambush. You know, at 20 meters, 25 meters, that really doesn't ever come out too well, even in the planning process. But I've been to Afghanistan prior for a year, and I saw combat. I got a Purple Heart. I've seen how I would react. Now, this was a little different situation. It was a little bit closer, and it was a little more intense than what I was used to. But, you know, you don't think, like I said, it's just react.
You know, the bond that we hear develops between soldiers in a unit during combat is something most of us will never experience in our lifetime. I wonder if you can help us understand that bond, what it's like to be with a group of soldiers and depend on each other in the way that you do, to a civilian.
I think the best terms would be like a brother. I mean, everyone that I've met in the Army has come from so many places in the United States and Puerto Rico and Guam, and we're all here doing the same thing, and we're all put through some of these tests and some of these challenges together. But by the end of it, you know, the hottest fires help forge the hardest metals, and I think that bond we have as war creates our own brotherhood, and That's really the best way I can put it.
The aspects of being in a combat situation or on patrol is a better way to say it. What will you miss most about that?
Wow, that was a difficult question. What will I miss most?
What will you remember most fondly being with those men?
The times we've shared. I mean, the things that you find funny in combat or in difficult situations are usually not funny to you when you're sitting on your couch at home, sipping a soda, eating popcorn, watching a movie.
For example, you have anything that comes to mind?
Nothing for the radio, I don't think, because it takes... Maybe for some other book or something like that, but I don't want to go too far. Just it's strange the things you find funny.
Mm-hmm. The Medal of Honor is awarded to those who went above and beyond the call of duty. Do you feel like what you performed that day was above and beyond the call of duty?
I think
certainly
I did.
Sounds like it, according to this report.
I think I did what everyone else was doing. I think because of the circumstances and because of the piece that I did is what people are calling above and beyond, but I don't think there's anyone in Afghanistan or Iraq right now that you can't say is going above and beyond the call of duty. I mean, they're leaving their families, they're leaving their wives, their children, their mothers, their fathers, their grandparents. They're leaving life in a fairly secure country behind to go to a third world country and fight. So that seems pretty much to me above and beyond.
Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta, you are now a national hero. You have been awarded the Medal of Honor. It gives you a platform that only a very select group of people have. How do you plan to use this honor?
I hope that with this honor and with this platform that it is providing, that I can really put the word out, because I think that the American soldier, the American service member, the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard, the Air Force, the National Guard, the Reserve, all of them are doing such an incredible job and have been doing such an incredible job for quite a while now. And I just want to make sure that the people understand that, because they're not necessarily just doing it for themselves, they're doing it for every American citizen.
My conversation from 2010 with Army Staff Sergeant Sal Junta of Hiawatha, the first living person since the Vietnam War to receive the Medal of Honor. And that wraps up this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. That wraps up Iowa Week for our talk shows. It's been a lot of fun. We hope that you've enjoyed it as much as we have. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Help today from Phil Moss in Cedar Falls. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.